Before we get started here, I have a report from one of our spies at North Bergen High School. These are little notes that you don't hear in the regular high school news and in the news of the Jersey provinces. We at North Bergen High celebrated a milestone on April 21st for this year. On that Tuesday at about 1:30 p.m., we experienced our first bomb scare of the season. We had a locker raid for dope back in November, but this was the first bomb scare this season. We have averaged 2.5 bomb scares and or dope raids since the school was built 2.5 years ago. We now tune in to a typical friendly locker room gathering just outside of North Bergen High School's main auditorium hallway. All right, that's enough, Axel, there. That was very good. Very good. That sounds like a fun school. In fact, we had some interesting things happen in my school. There are a lot of things, even at this date, I don't wish to poke any sores that have not healed. It's funny. Nobody ever really writes much about the way it really is in life. How it really was in high school, things like that. Bomb scare. I'll never forget the time in the middle of the afternoon, there was a fire drill in the school that I was attending. You know, and you get used to those fire drills, you know, just they start banging the gong and everybody jumps up and marches in order to the fire escape door that you have assigned to your room, and you know, march away, and the teacher goes out with you, and everybody sort of looks dully and marches around. Well, we had this great fire. It actually happened. There was a gong and there was a fire, and it seems that a group of malcontents had tossed large pieces of paper, all wrapped into bundles. You know, they just squished it all together. They made like balls of paper, and they squished enough of them together, and then they soaked them with lighter fluid, which they then lit and then threw up into a chandelier in the main hallway. The chandelier was one of these big glass things, you know, that hung down, and they had filled them up. Well, apparently they had filled it up with these. They tossed about 25 of those up there and then finally lit the last one. You know, like the scene that you see in when they're storming the western fort, the Indians are throwing. They had lit the last one and tossed it up there and took off. Well, it caused considerable excitement in English, too, I can tell you. Well, of course, you never see that when you see the Andy Hardy movies. You know, they don't show that kind of stuff. And this TV show they've got about high school, they didn't have anything like that in high school. I can tell you a few other little bits like that. And my school was notably a calm school. Although the old concept of the school burning down rarely has happened. Well, I actually went to a school that burnt down. I was one of the more surrealistic moments in my life. And I think we are a composite of all kinds of wild memories, which most of us don't even attempt to dredge up. I mean, never. And you don't even think that you have these things. There's a collection of stuff. Like the other night when I was out at the Limelight, some family came out there to see the show, and they had with them a kid, and he was about 10 or 11. The kid comes up to me and says, "Say, do those things that you talk about, did they really happen?" "Well, yes, son, they did really happen, now that you mention it. And they happened to your old man, and they're happening to you, too. The only trick is to know that they're happening, that's all. And, of course, to recognize that they have happened, and then to honestly deal with them as best you can," which is the hardest part, actually, kid. I remember this once. Of course, you know, they always have a secret idea of burning down the authority. You know, everybody wants to burn down the city hall. In fact, I'll tell you this. What time is it? 22 minutes past 10. And now you're all out there busily willing yourself better tomorrow. It's 22 minutes past 10. And you can knock off willing there for a minute. If I were to yell out at you, "All right, it's late now, okay? It's quiet out, it's dark. What better time now than to storm the city hall? Let's go and burn it down now." You'd be surprised at how many guys would assemble just to do that very thing. They'd rush out and go down and burn it down for no other reason than they like a fire, you know. They like the lights in the sky and the yelling and people running around and squirting stuff with hoses, you know, the whole action. Because we have a terrible desire to become involved in something if we can. And even if it's a terrible thing, we want to be involved. Well, we all have the secret idea that someday, you know, you hate your job, we'll say. You know, everybody secretly does it, a little ways, all kinds of things. That you don't want to get fired from B, 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 D, and O, and Y, and L, or wherever it is you work. But it would be kind of nice if it blew up tonight. You know? Boom! Wellington Boring blows up, you know, and all the people, you'd cry crocodile tears, and you'd come down, and there'd be a big hole in the ground, you see, where all the desks were. And there would be a vague sense of relief, you know. It's surprising how many people welcome a war for that very reason. A sense of relief, you know. You always pretend like you don't want war to come. There goes Altoona. And everyone, you know, there's a sense of kind of relief, and it always was a traffic jam outside of Altoona, and it was a kind of a, you know, it was a trap there, you know, it was tickets every time you go through the town. Up goes Hackensack. Well, people would cry, but yet they wouldn't have to go there anymore, you know? Or even go through it. It's funny. It's a strange scene. So I'm a kid, you know, there's always this almost a paradisical yet a kind of a joke thing about the school burning down. People always, you know, that idea that what would you like most, Charlie? And they always say, what is it? Do you want the school to burn down? Well, nobody ever expects to have it blow up. I know that there are a lot of reasons why this outfit should blow up, but it won't. And I don't have any idiotic ideas or dreams that it will. And so one day when I'm a kid, this actually happened. We went home for Christmas vacation, and they have a couple of weeks, I guess, and there was a week before Christmas, and then a week or so after Christmas, and the temperature is 148 below zero out there in Chicago, and there's, you know, the wind is blowing and howling, and the snow is piled up, and when you come out of school, you split out, just like you do from work, you don't really get away from it. It doesn't make any difference. It's always with you. I'm sure that there must be 87 million guys driving around in Mercuries and stuff listening to the show who are not working, but work is with them. It's like a wart on the top of your head, you know. There it is. It's just sitting there like a mushroom growing out of your ear or something, and it's there. Now, that doesn't mean you don't like it or anything. It is important that we have it, work. Oh, yes. Without work, I think we would be dead ducks, as each and every one of us. But it's there. You hate it and you love it at the same time. It's always there. So, yeah, sure. And I imagine 45 guys are driving around. If I say, look, Dad, if you could quit work and not work at all ever again in your life, what would you do? So 45, oh, boy, when I grab that, wow. Yeah, sure. Yeah, I know you'd grab it. Yeah, I know. Yeah, that's the trouble, you know, with man. He always does grab the thing that is least good for him. You know, if given your choice, absolute choice, most guys would live on marshmallows and beer. Given the choice, that's right. Some nutty thing like that, completely. Well, I'm a kid, see, and we're out of school. And I learned this one great lesson. It's Christmas vacation, and yet school is with you, you know. It's kind of there, you're out of it, and we're fooling around and hitting each other and doing all the stuff and breaking things. You know how you are. You're off for a couple of weeks. And one night, it must have been about maybe a day after Christmas. I mean, I think it was like Christmas 2 days later or something. Oh, it must have been 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. There's a lot of yelling and hollering, and there are wild sirens and screams of trucks going past the house. And the school was about 4 blocks down the street at that time. It was a grade school that I was going to. One of these, what they call a portable. And I could hear the sirens whistling past everybody yelling. It's 2 in the morning and people are hollering. And, of course, I'm asleep. I'm a kid. I don't know anything about this. The next morning, it turns out that the school burnt down. I mean, literally burnt down. About 9/10 of the school was gone. And it looked like bomb, what's left after a giant 500-pounder hits, you know. About half of the school, the roof was falling in, and most of it was just gone. There was just a lot of holes in the ground and wood and stuff sticking around the desks and stuff. And my half of the school where I was going at the time, I must have been about in fourth grade. In fact, I was in fourth grade. I can tell you distinctly. I was in fourth grade. It was still there. The roof was sagged down, and it was kind of charred, but there it was. It was sort of still there. Well, so everybody rushed down and looked, and we're all standing around. Well, now, you don't know what to do. You see, when the thing that you want actually happened, you don't know whether to cheer or whether to get scared. Actually, what you do is both. You cheer, and at the same time, you're worried. And so, yeah, that's right. You know, you're cheering and you're worrying. And so the school's burned down. We're standing there looking at the school, and we're feeling kind of funny about this. And of course, immediately the wild rumor runs through all the kids that were gathered down there to look at the dead body. That school, we would not have school now for at least a month, you see. Well, of course, what happened is that was scotched immediately. There was school as usual. And we went back to school, and I sat in the classroom. They brought us into the burned-out school. We actually went to a burned-out school. And we sat in this classroom, and you could smell the smoke. You know, they had some kind of a beaver board walls, you know, those funny pressed yellowish kind of, well, it's beaver board, I guess, is what they call it. And it burns in a very strange way. It has a strange smell like old cigar butts or something. And this was all burnt. You could smell water, and you could see all kinds of rags and dirt and stuff where the firemen had dragged their hoses through the halls. It was all battered. And we're sitting in class there. I remember a wild thing, and they put cardboard up over the windows, you see, so we could... The windows were all busted, of course, and they had cardboard up, and we were in this place. You couldn't look out anymore now. The classroom was completely enclosed, and you could smell smoke, and everything was kind of wet and cruddy, and there were rags. I remember there were rags piled up by the doors. Well, I'm sitting in there with all the kids, and Miss Robinette is in there. We're smelling the smoke, and the kids, it was very surrealistic. And they had run kind of emergency lights in. They had all kinds of wiring in, and they had light bulbs hanging. We're sitting in the burned-out school. It was like being in a bomb-damaged place. And cold, oh boy, was it cold in this joint. Oh boy, speaking of cold things, this is WOR AM at FM New York, and we got a couple of whoopee things here for you. There we go, Al. There we go.
Look, there, guys and gals.
Oh boy, look at that gang. Now out of their skulls.
Pounding syrup. Come on in. Hot sun. Cold beer.
Oh, beard up.
Beach on Valentine.
Wow. Oh, whoopee.
Get a smile
every time with a Valentine.
Beer at Valentine.
Look at that beer. Oh, reach boy. For a can. Right off the ice.
Oh, man. Come on.
Man.
Wow.
That's moving that beer off the shelves. You got another one? Oh, no, we have a live one here. Let's see. This is that Pan Am thing. Let's see. Columbus did it 459 years ago. What? Oh, that. Oh, yeah. I see what he did. Yeah, Columbus did it 459 years ago. When are you going to discover South America? It's the most fabulous vacation bargain ever. You just read the headlines, and you'll find you'll have an exciting time in South America. Take a Pan Am jet down and see. The shops, restaurants, and nightclubs are fully sandbagged and compare with anything that Europe can offer. The Chilean lake country reminds many people of Switzerland. Fishing, hunting, and sightseeing can't be matched anywhere, and it's all within easy reach by Pan Am Jet, the world's most experienced airline. See, phone 973-4000 for Pan Am. 973-4000 for Pan Am, world's most experienced airline. Yeah, it's a funny thing about that. I was talking one time to a British pilot. And how did it come about? It was a funny thing. He was discussing one airline, which we will not mention. He was discussing one airline, he says, which is fully staffed with guys who know more about flying over various cities in Europe at 27,000 feet altitude. He says they're the most experienced guys flying over these various European cities at night. They're very experienced, he says, thank you. You're trying to think about what I mean by that. Well, you know, all pilots didn't always fly from Idlewild. They flew from other fields and in other kinds of planes. There, it's beginning to soak in there to you there. It's very interesting. Yeah, in fact, this one pilot tells me that there's one city in particular. He flies one of the big international routes, and he says there's one city. Whenever he hears in his earphones that they are now within 400 miles of it, he gets down on the floor. You know, he's waiting for the flak to come flying up. Very nervous every time he comes to the city. He says they had a particularly good fighter squadron stationed right outside of that city in a certain woods. And he says this fighter squadron was like the Ted Williams among fighter squadrons. You know, they had a high batting average. And he says every time, he ducks down, you know, and he waits, you know, for the waste guns to start. Oh, there's a lot of things to be seen in the world if you know how to look for it, you know. I'll never forget one time coming down the just a couple of years ago, as long as we're talking about transatlantic flying, which is extremely exciting. I remember, of course, the actual flying isn't, to be honest with you. It's pretty dull, actually. That's why you just eat all the way. You know, you just eat, you take off, and you just eat. You stuff yourself all the way to Europe. You know, you go reeling out, your eyeballs are sticking out, you're sweating, and you're burping. It's awful. That may be vulgar, but that's what happens, honey. I'm sorry. But I do remember one wild scene. Oh, it's true. I remember flying into this city in Mittel Europa, and I'm in this airplane, and we're coming down about dusk. It was a little before dusk. It was around 5:30, something like that. And you could see dusk is approaching. You can see it when you're up in the air. You know, you can just see the sunset approaching, coming along the ground. You're half in shadow, and you're half in bright sunshine. And so we're coming down, and I'm looking out of the plane, and all these happy people are sitting around in the plane. They're eating Nabiscos and knocking down beer and yelling and hollering. And we're coming in. And we came down into this airfield, and it was big runways all over the place. And over towards the left of one of the runways, which is the one that we were coming in on, parallel to us, I see this long, low, flat series of what looked like concrete foundations. Well, they weren't concrete foundations. What they were actually, of course, was old, used concrete blockhouses. And they were just laying down there, you see. Oh yeah, and they were half buried, and this is this was quite an infamous airfield in its time, and I knew a little bit about it, you see. And we're coming in, I looked down, I could see all those things, just they were still there, you see. And the plane landed, and we're taxiing around, and we came up to the administration building, which had been all jazzed up since its halcyon days, and it's glass, and it was glass. You know how people? It was funny. You know how people? As you walk around New York here, you see a lot of it here, where they will renovate the bottom half of a building. From about the second story down, you know, they have glass blocks and chrome and all this jazz. And if you look up at the top, the building is roughly 1874. You know, it's got gargoyles and boarded up windows, and you can see a faded sign that says pool room, tables for ladies in the rear, clean your own spittoon and all that junk, you know. And, well, this was like that. You don't expect to see an airline terminal that way. I'm using the popularized phrase there. The bottom half was fantastic. You know, it just looked like all big, great airline terminals in our time. Green glass, a lot of chrome, and a lot of aluminum and stainless steel and all that stuff. But above that, you could see this concrete went up. It was one of these sort of a stucco concrete buildings. You could see pockmarks all over it. Was like it had eczema. Well, the pock marks came from all kinds of little pieces of flying tin and metal and stuff. And well, there were little pock marks, and in the middle of all the little pock marks, you could see where it had been removed forcibly, apparently by a crowbar, by the PR department, probably. There was a gigantic eagle, you could see, where it had been taken off. You could see the discolored places. And yeah, oh yeah, there it was. See. So very funny. And I came in through this place, and they have a little hot dog stand and all that. And it's the only hot dog stand that I ever saw that had 6-inch steel walls. It had apparently been the CO's quarters or something before that, you know. And if you fly around, if you do fly much flying in this world, you fly over areas where you think, if you have that feeling, you think of the different kinds of guys who have flown through this same air, and looking down on the same site, because when you're above a country, let's say you're 15 or 20,000 feet flying over a country, it always looks peaceful. It really does. And they all look pretty much the same, which is so fascinating. That flying, say, at 15,000 feet over, let us say, France, reminds you for all the world of flying at 15,000 feet over Indiana. Oh, very similar. You see a river down there in the hills, and it's green, a little snow here and there, and you see lights of cars and things. It is almost impossible to tell one city or one country from the other at anything above 15,000 feet. The surface differences all begin to immediately be ironed out. And not too long after the war, I recall sitting in a plane flying, and we were flying. I was flying from Amsterdam to, I don't know how I got on this subject, it was not on the agenda, but I was flying from Amsterdam to Munich. Well, now, other airplanes had flown from Amsterdam to Munich, or actually the other way around, and I was in the air there, and I'm looking down, and you can see this countryside down there, kind of soft, green countryside, and we got out of our water, and then we finally approached, we got over the continent, you know, and we're flying inland, and I'm thinking of what kind of flight this would have been just a few years prior. It would have been a very exciting flight. I mean, there wouldn't have been many stewardesses around, and the food would have been different, but let me tell you, there would have been some action. And I'm looking down there, and coming back then, this is very interesting when you're up in the air. Most people, when they're up in the air, expect to stay up in the air. Well, when you're in a military aircraft, under certain conditions, you don't expect to stay up in the air. You actually expect not to stay up in the air. It's exactly the opposite adjustment. And every time the thing comes down and actually lands, you can't believe that you actually made it. The wings flop, on all those military aircraft, the wings flop, the great big B-24s, the wings, they're like giant sparrows. They call them the boxcar, and they really were. I don't know whether you've ever heard a boxcar going past at 2 o'clock in the morning under a full head of steam. Well, that's the way the 24 sounded, and roughly the way it flew, sort of square and just sort of lump through the air. And you sit in this thing, and you could see the wings going up and down and everything creaking. Every last joint in an airplane creaks. Now, you don't know about that, but most of these airplanes today are all completely insulated. Now, they don't insulate them only from the cold. They insulate you from some reality there, like those wires and all that stuff running around in the guts there, and all those transducers that can go bad and things and stuff that creaks. Well, when you're in a naked military aircraft where everything has been torn out, it's just the bare skin, and the only insulation you got is this woolen suit. They put a suit and a leather suit, and the thing plugs in, and it's heated and all that. Well, your ears can hear and everything. It's going, and your plates are rattling and rivets are jiggling up and down. Oh, yes, indeed. Sure, you sit in there, it's like, I'll tell you what it's like. It's like being in an airborne automobile wreck. It really is, oh, yes, these things are not made for comfort, then when it comes down, they don't really they don't land the way they land out at Idlewild. They usually hop. Most of the pilots have had a good full 42 hours of actual flying in this type of aircraft, and it goes, and you hang on, see, and then you're airborne again. You're airborne again. Oh, Charlie, we're down. And you look back, and Charlie's got three fire extinguishers in his arms. He said, "We're not stopped yet." Oh, my. Every time I do a show like this, I get 5,000 angry letters from... Oh, yeah, it's a very funny scene. But then flying over various parts of the world can be very exciting. Just the mere fact of flying itself. I probably the most spectacularly exciting flight that I know of around. Of course, there are some that are obviously exciting. For example, flying over the Alps is obviously exciting. But it's exciting in a way that I have to say is probably conventional exciting. It's conventional beauty, and it's certainly spectacular and beautiful, but conventional. Boy, I'll never forget the time, though, flying over the Alps, going from... it was the Italian Alps. Going from... where was I going from? Zurich, that's it, to Rome. Or the other way. I was going from Rome to Zurich. And a gigantic storm belted us. Oh, boy, that was a wild one. I was in this... it was in a caravel. No, it was not a caravel. Come to think, it was an old Super Connie, Constellation. And I took off from the Rome airport, and I was with another guy. We made a circle, and we circled over. Usually, generally, what most of the pilots do flying out of Rome, they circle, if it's in the daytime and the light is right and they're in a good mood, they generally circle the Colosseum. Yes, it's a fantastic sight. Rome is incredible from the air. You just can't believe it from the air. And they circle it, and they tilt way over so you can see down, and you're hanging on one wing, you know, you're going, everybody's got their seatbelt on, and they make this big bank around the Colosseum and over the Forum, and then he slowly climbs and heads north. And the next thing you know, you're at an altitude, and your ears are popping, and you're over the Alps. Well, we were about halfway through the Alps when some of this gigantic storm came rolling down. Oh, boy, was it a storm. Big purple and white and gray and jagged clouds. And that poor little Super Connie started to flop. And she was not in trouble, of course, but really was getting belted around. We were in these big, because when you get into mountain flying, you get very erratic winds, and you get storms that are thunderheads and everything else, and this was late summer yet. And so we were really belted around, and I could see this thing. She was leaking water all over the place. Rain was pelting at us, and water leaking in. You could see it trickling along. And these guys up in front, you know, I could just see them up there, all belted in, with their doors closed, everything closed, their lights out, flying that son of a gun for all it was worth. And she'd climb. You could feel them just clawing in the air, you know, trying to climb. And you should see once in a while. And by the way, what happened then was that it began to close in. And it's very scary to be flying in really rough mountains with no visibility. And so these guys are trying to get altitude, and then we'd feel the drop again. You know, they hit that big pocket. She's clawing. You see those props chewing away at the air, and then we hit the other side of the Alps, the Swiss side of the Alps, and it was like going downhill. You know, we went down. And he just laid it down, and there it was, beautiful weather. And there below us was Switzerland, just incredible. Switzerland lays there like some kind of a postcard, you know, just, we go down into this thing. Whoo, boy. And I could see the stewardess was sweating a little bit, and she's running up and down. She's sweating because we could feel it. Well, I think, though, probably the single most exciting air view is to fly. Of course, this is an exotic flight, and I don't think many of you will do it. But this is a flight that goes from Algiers, that flies directly south over the Sahara to Central Africa. Now, if you ever want to try an experience, this is something to see, and make sure that you do it in the daytime. It's nothing at night. It's nothing but blackness at night. You see no lights down there. You're just flying in a vacuum. But flying it in the daytime with the Sahara sun beating down on that desert is a sight you could not believe. It is just incredible. It's like literally flying over some kind of a brick red ocean. It does not look at all like sand, what you consider sand. It looks like an ocean, and it's as though, as far as you can see, waves, wave after wave after wave. There, it's the dunes, of course, waves, and as far as you can see. And of course, you usually fly over that area in the world. You usually find a pretty good altitude because of a number of reasons. Desert flying is also tricky due to thermals and updrafts and heat and one thing and another. And so they fly pretty high over the desert. And way down below, in the middle of this fantastic desert, you see a little tiny scratch in the sand. It looks like a little scratch, and you take out your glasses. I always travel with binoculars when I travel any real wild traveling. You see this little scratch in the sand, and you look down there, and you see it's a tiny airstrip carved out of the sand. It's a French Air Force unit down there in the middle of the desert, just a million miles from any place. That little tiny white scratch, and it's like a little cross, you know, that little cross. And you can see a little tiny dot, and you put those glasses, and you focus it in, and it's a sheet metal hangar. And you see drawn out a couple of French Mistada jets just laying down there, just little dots. And you think, oh, boy, talk about being stationed in a hole. Incredible, you know, because you're up there, you can see there's nothing for billions of miles, and you look down there, and you can just see these guys festering. You know, you just have this sense of total desolation. Well, then once in a great while, of course, yeah, I can go on and on about desert, the desert flying and all this. This is a very, very exciting thing. And you'll see an occasional oasis. Now, if you have a chart with you, it's not easy to read a desert chart either, because desert charts don't have the usual landmarks like, river, Pittsburgh. You know, they don't have various things you can orient on. And you can just guess. And there's all little places like Uri El Akbar. And it's a little tiny. You look down there, and there's one tree, you see, and you see one guy looking up. Little tiny thing in the middle of all this nothing. And he's looking up at you, you know. And you realize this is really the, boy, I'll tell you, this is really the part of the world where the world takes over and people stop. People are not supposed to be here. And you then, of course, the sun on the desert is a very special thing. The color of the air and everything else due to the sand that's been blown up over countless centuries, the sand that's been lifted up by various winds until finally at tremendous altitude, something like 40 or 50,000 feet, usually much higher than aircraft usually flies, there is an actual layer of suspended sand over the desert. It's been there for as long as people have been there, probably longer. Once in a while, some of it comes down. That's called a sandstorm. No, really, that sand hangs up there, and the sun shines through it. And of course, what it does is diffuse the sun. The sun is not as clean as it is here. You know, you people, of course, usually people who've never been in that area of the world think of the sun as a clean dot. There it is. It's up there. This big round thing. You can see where it is. Well. Due to the fact that this sand is up there, the sun's rays are diffused over the whole sky. And the whole sky looks like it's one big sun. It looks like it's brass. You can't really point out where the sun is. Yeah, it's an insane sight. It's brassy. It's gold-colored. They often refer to it as the brassy desert sky in bad fiction. But it isn't really brassy. I shouldn't say brassy. It's like looking as though you're looking at some kind of heated metal that goes over the whole sky. You can't really see the sun. And better you can't, because there's no sun in the world like that sun. That sun bake you to a crisp in about 20 minutes if you stand out in it. Oh, yes, you get dehydrated almost instantly there. And flying over this is something because of the peculiar clarity of the air. Now, most of us are used to flying in temperate areas where there is a haze. The haze is caused, of course, by moisture in the air and so on. Well, of course, there's no moisture there. They got none. So the air is as clear, well, it's unbelievably clear, and you feel as though you're literally suspended over something that isn't real. It's as though, I can't describe it except to say that it doesn't seem like flying or anything. You're hanging there. And this thing is down below you. It looks like a carpet. It doesn't look like country or land. And it just goes on and on and on and on. And then gradually, what really is interesting is as you begin to approach, as you go over the area where Timbuktu and you get further on down south towards Central Africa, you begin to approach the northernmost frontier of Nigeria and these countries. And gradually it begins, you begin to see little splotches of green here and there. And then the next thing you know, almost as though somebody has thrown a switch, it's just the next thing you know, you are over exactly the opposite. You are over a gigantic jungle that goes on and on. And this again, of course, is another sight. Most people, of course, flying over jungle is not like flying over Indiana either. Although it can be, I suppose, at a certain altitude. But a jungle has another strange look when you're above it. It looks like a sea. It does not look like ordinary ground or land, and it looks strangely like you can land on it. It has the look that if the airplane went down, it could just land on this. You know, it looks like some kind of a big green. It looks like a golf green. Absolutely unbroken. It's just this long, flat thing. And then you see an occasional little rise in it. Just a little rise, and no breaks. And then, off in the distance, you see a break, a slit in it. Literally a slit, like two cliffs, just a slit. That is a river. And this river is flowing through this fantastic jungle, and you get over it, and you can just see it down there. You have to look straight down to see the river, because these trees are maybe 150 feet tall, giant jungle trees. So this is a pretty spectacular flight. I would recommend it to you. Another thing about that flying in that section of the world, of course, is the kind of passengers that are in your plane. This to me is the most exciting part of international travel, particularly international travel in areas of the world that aren't often traveled by too many tourists, because of the wildly interesting group of passengers that you will find on an aircraft that is flying in that area of the world. Most people will be flying, they'll be flying insane places. A guy will be going, he'll be on his way to Tibet, and he's decided to stop off for a while at Kano. Yeah, this kind of thing, you just can't believe what the way these people, where they're going, what they're doing. And they're all bound on something which seems to you, as you sit there in the plane, something incredibly mysterious. Somehow mysterious and vaguely illegal. You don't know why, it just seems illegal. Why should a guy be going, you say to yourself, to Damascus with 400 pounds of leatherette wallets? Now, why is he doing that? You know, what is he covering up for? And he sits over there, and they all, every last one of them on those international flights, I'm talking about the real international flights. I'm not discussing, you know, just going out and taking the plane to Paris. So the really international flights, you find every one of these people are of an almost indeterminate nationality. And incidentally, they all speak about 45 lesser-known languages. You'll hear somebody talking in faultless English, and he'll say something. Oh, he says, "Excuse me, sir," and he'll talk to you. And then he'll break out in Urdu to somebody, or what sounds like Urdu. It sounds like it's being played backwards. Then he'll stop, and somebody will say something in Dutch behind him, and he talks Dutch. And you're sitting there feeling about, you can't imagine how inferior you feel. And also, you somehow feel as though you have gotten in touch with life now at last. And women, the most interesting women. It is not at all like Steve Canyon, not that kind, but I mean very interesting people all over the world. And the more you fly around it, the more you're involved in it, the more the world, you just get so hung up on it, you can't stop. You just can't stop. And you sit in the plane, and they serve food. Of course, in most of these international flights, again, it is not like taking the big red carpet trip to London, where they serve sort of American food. You'll sit in a plane that's on its way, let's say, from, just pick some place, let's say, Algiers to Lagos, we'll say, for example. Well, you get in this plane, and you're liable to get almost anything served to you. I mean, almost anything. And wine, they all are connoisseurs of wine, of every type of wine. And, of course, you get in the plane, they start serving you Algerian wines and African wines, which most people are not used to having, and African beers, which are, by the way, incredibly good. You cannot believe how good many of the African beers are really great beers. They drink beer there like we drink coffee. Did you know that? It's even bigger than baseball and Valentine's. They drink beer everywhere. And so you start getting these big, great, big bottles of beer they bring to you in these planes. And you get a feeling. It's a great feeling. But then you begin to have a great feeling about being an American, you know. I don't mean a feeling of chauvinism. You feel like you're the representative. it's like being at some big convention. And there's the representative from New Jersey, there's the representative from Ohio, and there's the representative from Utah. Well, it's as though you're in this airplane and you're the representative from the United States. I rode with a Pakistani, for example, for about 2.5 hours over about 18 million miles of Africa. And he and I talked about Pakistan. It was a very interesting discussion. He said some things about Nehru that would have curled, you know. And so we're sitting there, and they all look infinitely wise. That's another thing. And you develop, after you have sat in several international planes, an infinitely wise look yourself. Oh, yes, you do. And I don't mean you put it on. You've been there. I don't know how to express it. You've just been there. And so you sit there, and they bring you the... And you begin to develop very quickly a taste in various types of Algerian wine. And so you call for your favorite Algerian wine, and they bring it to you, and immediately you're one of the... You know, there's just no question anymore. You're one of the boys. Like all over Central Africa, I started to call for this certain type of Johannesburg blackberry juice. And it is not served here in the United States. It is a fantastic drink. See? And I would call for it in the language that the label was written on, which was Boer, which is a kind of a, well, it's an African Dutch. I'd go out, I'd belt this out, you know. And they'd say, yassa, yassa. And they would bring it to me, and I'd sit there. And, of course, they realized naturally that I was smuggling hot pearls. I was on my way to Calcutta by way of Bombay, Beirut, and the Lesser Hebrides. And I was making an interesting little deal at each place on the way.